Good morning, Valley Church. How are we all doing this morning? Yes, I think at this point we could just go home after the worship and Fresh Prince of Haran. I don't know who he was, but anyways, thank you guys so much for joining us. My name is Travis Carson, one of the pastors here at Reality Church. Welcome to our live streaming online, to everyone who watches this online, even those of you in Sweden. We found a way of people in Sweden that like watch our services here, so glad you're here. So the Intentionals 2, if you guys missed Intentionals 1, that was like 2 years ago, but you can still go back and check them out on our app or on our website, where we are looking at characters from the Old Testament, people, real people with real hurts and real flaws and scars that God still uses in incredible ways. Sometimes we get to the point where you feel like, God couldn't use me because I got this, but we're looking at some characters here over the next couple weeks. These are the characters, though, that growing up, if you grew up in church, even if you didn't grow up in a church, you probably heard of most of these guys. I mean, these are the awesome stories that we tell the kids back in Reality Kids. I mean, your kid will never come home with a picture of, like, Paul planting a church in Ephesus, right? Like, you've never seen that craft before. It's, you know, you get, like, the smiling lion with Daniel, and everyone's happy, or, you know, the week we did one with Gideon, we made these, like, little flaming torches for the kids. My daughter brought home this amazing piece of art. This was back in October. We saved it. Yeah, there it is. That's hanging in our fridge still. Okay, this is, if you can't tell, this is a color copy of a rock on cardstock. Now, I think there was a craft involved, some like tissue paper, some water coming out of this rock, but she came up to us and told me all about Big Kid Moses. Big Kid Moses. And this served as like a visual reminder for her of that story she heard back there. You know, a few months ago, some of you guys know me, I've recently stepped in position here as the children's pastor. I've been here for about 2 months now. I've been doing student ministry for the last 7 years, so this has kind of been a bit of a transition for me. Things are a little different from going from bigger kids to the littler kids, but it's really kind of caused me to pause and reflect on what it was like for me growing up in the church. I mean, I was definitely a church kid growing up. I was a church kid who did walk away from the church for a while, but God wouldn't leave me alone. Whole other story, but growing up, I remember when I was in kindergarten, or actually before, I was in preschool. I still remember this. Grandma Dorothy, she wasn't my grandma, that's what we called her. She did children's church with us, and she would sing, praise him, all ye little children. God is love. She had this like really weird way she would say that. I remember, God is love. And she was like from Michigan, so she didn't really have an accent. I mean, I don't know what it was, but I remember Grandma Dorothy and the way I just like felt around her. We went to this club at our church. We did on Monday nights, and there was this guy there. My first time I went, I was in kindergarten. His name was Chris Brown. Not celebrity Chris Brown, like a way cooler Chris Brown. And he was the coolest person I'd ever met. He must have been like in junior high or something. And Chris is like, hey, I want to be your buddy. I was like, cool. And the next week I went, Chris was there. And the next week I went, Chris was there. I met Chris when I was in kindergarten. And when I moved to Nebraska when I was in eighth grade, Chris invited me and my youth group friends over to his parents' house, cooked a big spaghetti dinner. And I remember Chris, just how he made me feel. I remember even one time I had this funny sweatband on and I said it was an American flag. He told me it was a French flag. I still remember this stuff. I remember Mr. Wygant. He was my fourth grade Sunday school teacher. And I called him up at 7 in the morning, like most kids do, and said, hey, Mr. Wygant, just to remind you, today's my birthday. So instead of bringing donut holes like you normally bring, could you bring like real donuts? I like the jelly-filled ones. And he did. Of course he did. I remember Mr. Hargis, who would dress up as Noah, or Moses, was kind of like he just switched the beard out, you know? And he would lead us in the field behind the church, you know, finding Tootsie Rolls or manna. I remember Al Ross, this missionary who came to our church every summer and taught our vacation Bible school. He was the most dynamic, engaging speaker I think I've ever heard. And this guy taught children because that was how God wired him up. And so I remember all these people that built into me. And I went to this little A-frame church, about 130 people. It was like a big Sunday there in Michigan. But every week I went there, I saw God. I saw Christ. I felt that in the people at that church. It was this combination, right? My parents, they supported our faith at home, and we had those conversations. But it wasn't just them on their own. It was other caring adults from our church who built into me and spoke into my life, who spent time driving us to play paintball and taught me all about the intricacies of Star Wars and, you know, did Bible studies with us, bought me donuts even, cooked spaghetti. All these moments, these people that shaped me as a kid, as a student, and as a teen, I really believe it is why I am here today. And you guys know this, that we have a huge emphasis on this community here. That's why, you know, we're building more space, because this isn't big enough for our kids. If you have any kids, you've been back there, you know how crowded it is. And we want to make more space for those kids. But more important than that space, it's what's in the room right now. You know, Christ didn't step out of heaven to build church buildings. He came here to build the church, the body of believers, who you guys are. You know, I never had a chance to go back and say thank you to Uncle Al or Mr. Hargis or Mr. Weigand or all these, Grandma Dorothy, all these people. But my life was changed because they let God work through them and speak through them into my life. You know, being the new children's pastor here, I just want to take a minute to kind of bring some awareness to our whole church here that what we do back here in Reality Kids, this is not childcare. This is building a foundation of their faith. We're creating an environment where they can go and learn and come home and hopefully tell you about Big Kid Moses. But also, you're going to learn stuff in here and be mentored by the church, and you in turn mentor your kids. And as we're getting prepared for this new space, honestly, like right now, we are not giving the kids the best they can because we do not have enough people that are serving in Reality Kids. Now, we don't want everyone just to jump up, oh, okay, I'm a warm body filler. No, we want people who love God, who love others, and want to see an eternal impact made in the lives of people in this community. And so, I know this is a kind of little, weird little introduction here, but I want you guys to, some people ask, like, well, what do you need back in Reality Kids? Like, we just don't need small group leaders. If you enter into drama or acting, really compelling communicators, that's how our large group time is done. We've been doing videos right now because we don't have enough large group communicators. We need artists. We need people who do like to sit in small groups with kids. We need people who like to hold babies. In fact, we even, I'll talk about our 4:30 service. That's almost like a separate church plant. We have about, I think, about 150 people that show up here on Sunday nights, and our Reality Kids, we can't always have it every week because we do not have enough volunteers. And so as we're getting ready to prepare for this new space, pray about this. Because God has wired you up in a unique way. Everyone in this room has some gifts that God has given them that we can use to advance his kingdom. For me, I take this, you know, like I said, I have kids. This matters to me as a parent. I have three girls. If you guys ever seen them running around here, they're the cutest kids you can see. I know. But here's the hard thing. If you guys who have kids, especially three of the same gender, how do you name that third child, right? Because you've been through all like the good names, you know, and like you go through the list and stuff like that. Because you get to the point, you're like, well, no, I knew someone like that once, and they're like, actually, that name kind of rhymes. Actually, you know, I dated a girl with that name. That would just be weird. But names, though, like sometimes, you know, we would pick a family name or something with deep meaning, or sometimes we just go to, like, you know, the name book and find something we think is super cool. I actually read about how 2016, there is one boy's name that is just skyrocketing through the charts. It has gone up 2,368 spots. It has risen the charts. It squeaked in the top 1,000 names. And number 901, the most popular boy name of 2016, Kylo. Now, for those of the uninitiated, Kylo is a character from a little indie sci-fi flick called Star Wars. But he's a bad guy, okay? Like, we don't know what's going to happen in Kylo's life, but he's not a good guy in the first one he's in. But just about every name we find in the Bible has a meaning connected to it. Jesus in Hebrew means that the Lord is salvation, or God saves. Isaac means laughter, probably because his parents laughed when they heard that they were going to have a baby as they were reaching 100. Jacob, who we're talking about today, his name has a great meaning, heel grabber, or supplanter. Trickster, a deceiver. If you've been around the church at all, even not around a whole lot, you've heard the names Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. They're always kind of lumped up together because they all receive a covenantal promise from God. But Jacob was far, far different than his grandfather Abraham. See, Jacob, most of his life, he relied on his own ingenious wit and his cunning. He lived his life, he was driven by passion to get whatever he wanted for himself. He literally was grabbing and taking throughout his life. So every week you guys come in here, you know what we're talking about. You can probably look up here. I know we sang a song about it earlier. Arrogance, right? I mean, this is something that you don't find a verse in the Bible that says, thou shalt not be arrogant. But we know how arrogance, it gets itself wrapped up in pride, in self-reliance, and self-importance. We know what it looks like and we see it in other people, right? And it is ugly. But this struggle, this brokenness, it's in every one of us. In some way, shape, or form, it is in all of us. And occasionally it bubbles to the surface, but most of it is this internal struggle in relationships. How many times have you guys been in that conversation? Well, if they only, you know that I was right. They got what was coming to them. They deserved this. In our work, Some of us will step on others to get ahead, maybe even make unethical decisions, maybe cutting corners because it means a little bit more advancement for us because we think that we deserve this. We're taking this. This is ours. Even just like keeping up with the Joneses. I mean, this is kind of the hijacked version of the American dream, right? Get what you can, hold on to it, and don't let go. You deserve this. This is my time. No one's taking this from me. This is my life. And as we're going to look into the life of Jacob here, we're going to see again and again Jacob attempting to grab onto what he thinks he deserves and how those around him are simply there just to advance his own pursuits for happiness. So a lot happens in Jacob's life. Pretty much Genesis 25 through 50 is about Jacob. He's born to, he's an old man and his family and what happens. But in Genesis 25, we're going to read Rebecca, his mother, was praying to God, like, what's going on? There's something weird going on in my stomach here. Something feels a little funny. And the Lord told her that the sons in your womb will become two great nations. From the very beginning, the two nations will be rivals. One nation will be stronger than the other, and your older son will serve your younger son. Now, this is kind of backwards according to their tradition. Usually, the older son would end up being, you know, inherit more, would have what was called the birthright. And if you guys know the story, Genesis goes right from their birth into the infamous red stew debacle. If you ever seen like anything more appetizing in your life, man, actually we have an original. You have to put the original, there it is. This is the original Snapchat that Jacob sent out after he stole the birthright. All right. Here's how the story goes. Esau was out hunting in the fields and he came home and he was hungry. He was famished. He was so hungry, he was going to die. Okay. All right. Jacob said, well, first, you must swear your birthright is mine. So Esau swore an oath, therefore selling his rights as the firstborn to his brother Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and lentil stew, and Esau ate the meal, then got up and left. Like, this is like the worst transaction trade you will ever come across. He showed contempt for his rights as the firstborn. Now, a couple things about birthright. We don't really have anything like it in our culture today, but birthright meant three things mainly. First was financially. When the father passed away, the oldest son, who had the birthright often, would instantly receive twice as much as the other kids, sometimes three times as much. So you instantly became wealthy just because. The second thing it meant was authority. You kind of became an authority figure over the family. If there was like a dispute or an argument coming on, like, you know, we didn't all vote. Like, people just came in and told you what was going on and sat at your feet, and you said, okay, this is what we're going to do. And no one argued because you had that birthright. And the third perk was this concept of this blessing from God, that if you had the birthright, that God was almost forced to bless you and be with you in a way that he wouldn't be with the rest of your family. And so this is an extraordinary, valuable thing. And here we have Esau, the rugged, hairy, outdoors man, trading it away to Jacob, who we're told was gentle and soft and spent time with his mother in the tents. But Jacob was cunning, and these things of power, money, and blessing were all things that Jacob wanted. And so he took them. In this situation here, he saw that he had advantage over his brother and took it. But one more thing with this birthright was a little bit bigger than other birthrights. Along with this came a covenant, a promise that God had given to Abraham, this covenant of a land, of a nation, and eventually a Messiah. And so, Jacob, we're certain essentially that God had kind of told him that, you know, your son Jacob is going to be over Esau. But Jacob went and took something that he felt that he deserved. Jacob was guilty of taking something. Eventually, we know the birthright would have somehow passed on to Jacob, but he took what God had already said was his. But he wasn't finished yet with Esau. One day, when Isaac was old and turning blind, he called for Esau, his older son, his favorite son, and said, "My son?"
"Yes, father," Esau replied.
"I'm an old man now," Isaac said. "I don't know when I may die. Take your bow and quiver full of arrows and go into the open country and hunt some wild game for me. Prepare my favorite dish and bring it here for me to eat. Then I will pronounce the blessing that belongs to you, my firstborn son, before I die." Now, it's interesting here in Isaac, he's not the best guy, I guess you could say, in this situation. He knows what God said, but still, he's preferring Esau, his rugged, hairy, outdoors man. But Rebecca, I don't think you've ever had this before, like with your kids, parents in the room, you see something your kid does, you're like, yeah, that's from your side of the family. We kind of see in Rebecca, Jacob's mother here, where he gets maybe some of this cunning craftiness from.
Rebecca actually overhears this whole conversation, so she has a plan that they take Jacob and they dress him up in Esau's clothes so he smells like Esau. And they said they actually put lamb's wool on his hands and his neck because that's how hairy Esau was, so that if he gets too close and Isaac touches him, he'll feel his hairy lamb wool son. Maybe that's why he liked him. I don't know. So she goes out and gets a goat from their flock, kills it, cooks it, and Jacob goes in to give this to Isaac. And somehow, this crazy plan works. But Jacob somehow implicates God in his deception here. So Isaac says, how did you find this so quickly, my son? And it was like an hour ago. You know, it takes a while to go out, hunt an animal, bring it back, kill it, clean it, cook it. How did you find this so quickly? And Jacob, man, he just kind of rubs it right in God's face, essentially. He says, the Lord your God put it in my path. Like, how does God put up with this guy? Like, seriously, have you ever met someone like this before that, like, already you can start to see his arrogance shining through there? This trickster had no problem bringing God into his deception because he knew that God wanted him to have this birthright. So he justified any lie, any sin he committed in the pursuit of that. It didn't matter who got in his way. He deserved this. I got this. This is mine. But the blessings from God, something that was lost on Jacob. God's blessings, they're gifts to be received, not grasped. And especially those covenantal blessings. They were meant to be shared. They were meant to be bestowed on others, but Jacob was kind of more centered on hoarding these things for himself. So Jacob wasn't done yet with Esau. When Esau returned back after hearing this, he says, from that time on, Esau hated Jacob because their father had given Jacob the blessing. Esau began to scheme, I will soon be mourning my father's death, but then I will kill my brother Jacob. And so as you saw from our great video we started out with there, Jacob's parents sent him north to his uncle Laban's, his mother's brother's household, where he ends up spending quite a lot of time with his uncle. But along the way there, Jacob has this, again, I told you this, we have to kind of go through a couple of these parts of Jacob's story quick. He comes to this place that's later named Bethel. And he lays his head down on a stone. And I don't know if you sleep on a stone, if you get weird dreams or what. But Jacob has this vision, sees this ladder or this staircase that's reaching into heaven. And angels ascending along. And at the top of it, God is up there. And he speaks down to Jacob and tells him, I am with you. Now, this is important because this is God here reaffirming this covenantal blessing that he had told Abraham. But this is the first time Jacob is hearing this for himself from the mouth of God. I am with you and I will protect you wherever you go. And one day I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have finished giving you everything I have promised you. Is that? Oh, man, that's... You guys might have to take over back there because I think these things are a little out of order. Sorry. So, Jacob has this promise from God. And gosh, I don't know about you guys. Whenever I read these Old Testament stories, like I always say, like, man, if that was me, if I was there, I don't think I would have a problem the rest of my life. But we're going to see Jacob forgets so easily. He spends about 20 really frustrating years with his uncle Laban. Along the way, he falls in love with this girl, Rachel. Oh, Rachel, what do you know? She's Laban's daughter, and he agrees to work for his uncle, which for 7 years to marry Rachel. Pulls a switcheroo on him. He ends up serving his uncle for about 20 years, marries two of his daughters. Laban breaks a string of promises to Jacob. But Laban notices something about Jacob, that it seems that he is being blessed by Jacob's presence, by just being close to Jacob. So he doesn't want Jacob to leave just yet. Jacob has a family now. He's starting to have kids, and he wants to leave his uncle, but his uncle says, well, you know, I haven't really paid you in the past 20 years, so let's work something out here. So they agree that Jacob can name his price, and he names livestock as his price. And again, it's a story you should read for yourself. There's a lot to it. But essentially, Jacob has learned this skill called husbandry, or the breeding of animals, while he was spending time with Laban. And through this, he's able to gain a great deal of wealth at Laban's expense. But Jacob starts to notice that Laban's attitude towards him has changed. All of Jacob's flocks are huge and healthy, and Laban's are weak. And even Laban's sons are starting to grumble, man, Jacob is kind of stealing our inheritance. Don't forget, they're supposed to get something from their father when he passes. And so Jacob, feeling he'd been dealt with poorly by Laban in his response, kind of schemed the same way he did with Esau. He made another enemy. He exploits Laban for all he can. And doesn't even really say goodbye. He just takes his family and leaves. And after this increasing tension, they have a little bit of a confrontation where neither one really acts admirably. They split ways. And Jacob leaves Laban and heads back home. But back at home, Esau is waiting for him. Now, Rebekah told him before he left, don't come back until I send word that Esau has cooled off. He wants to kill you. I don't want that to happen to you. You're my favorite brother. But he's not heard word back that Esau has cooled down. And so here Jacob is, 20-some years later, returning to his brother. And he sends ahead of him all these servants and all of his livestock and this big procession towards Esau. And his messengers come back and they said, we met your brother Esau, and he's already on his way to meet you with an army of 400 men. Right? So Jacob is terrified when he hears this news. He divides his household along with all the flocks and herds and camels into two groups. He thought if Esau meets one group and attacks it, perhaps the other can escape. He's crafty. He's tricky. He's smart. He's prudent. I don't know. You might think that. But again, if we look at what the passage right before this, we'll see that Jacob once again has forgotten that God is with him. A passage right before this, Genesis 32, verse 1, says, as Jacob started on his way again, angels of God came to meet him. When Jacob saw them, he exclaimed, this is God's camp. And so he named the place Mahanaim. It wasn't that these angels just appeared. Like, this doesn't happen very often in the Bible, but Jacob got to see through into this unseen world and saw not that these angels just were showing up, they were already in their presence. He was in the presence of divine beings. So it doesn't say why these beings were here, but as we're going to find out, I imagine what was about, God maybe had said to them, hey, angels, something's about to happen. You got to come check this out. Like, you don't want to miss this. This is going to be like pay-per-view. Seriously, you need to be there in person, or an angel, or whatever he would call it. But you need to be there. Get down there and check this out. So Jacob has every reason to believe that God would protect him. But for some reason, he's instantly forgotten that God was there to protect him. And in his fear and distress, once again, he decides to take things on his own. And he finally gets to that moment where he realizes he's exhausted. He's tried everything he can. His whole life, I mean, there's so much more to this we don't know about Jacob's life. But from the little bit we know, I can imagine the kind of guy he was. At the last moment, when everything's exhausted, he has a moment we see in all those movies, right? Where every option is used and they look up. God, I know I don't talk to you very often, right? So Jacob goes to God with this prayer, and it's this incredible prayer. It's this humble prayer, filled with thanksgiving and humility, and he even quotes back God's word to him. He says, O God of my grandfather Abraham, God of my father Isaac, O Lord, you told me, return to your own land and to your relatives, and you promised me I will treat you kindly. I am not worthy of all the unfailing love and faithfulness you have shown to me, your servant. When I left home and crossed the Jordan River, I owned nothing except for a walking stick, and now my household fills two large camps. Oh, Lord, please rescue me from the hand of my brother Esau. I'm afraid that he's coming to attack me along with my wives and my children. But you promised me, I will surely treat you kindly, and I will multiply your descendants till they become as numerous as the sands along the seashore, too many to count. Jacob here isn't quoting this to God to remind God. He's quoting this back to God to just remember. Kind of like we did this morning with communion. It was a remembrance. His prayer had thanksgiving. He admitted that he was not worthy of all the blessings he had had in his life. He relied on what God promised to do. Finally, we see this moment. He's relying on what God promises to do and not his own worthiness, not his own scheming, not his own plans. And so Jacob has sent his whole family and all his wealth and everything far ahead, and he spends one last night alone on the east side of the Jordan River. Probably a night he's spent in prayer. See, God, I don't know if you've had this moment in your life where we have so many distractions. From the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed, our life is filled with noise and distractions. And God has finally got Jacob alone. I don't know if you've ever been in that place where you were alone with God and felt in this way, this revealing, this eye-opening moment. God had Jacob's attention. And what was about to happen was to be the turning point in Jacob's life, and he knew this. This left Jacob all alone in the camp, and a man came and wrestled with him until dawn began to break. This is a fascinating story. I know this is a great image here of an angel wrestling with Jacob. Most biblical scholars and commentators will agree that this was what we call a Christophany. This wasn't an angel, but this was actually Jesus, pre-incarnate Jesus, before he was born in Bethlehem, appearing. It happens a couple times throughout the Old Testament. But you notice here that Jacob didn't wrestle with a man came to wrestle with Jacob. See, Jacob didn't start out wanting anything from God, but I believe that God wanted something from Jacob here. We say this a lot. God doesn't want anything from you, right? But I think God wanted something from Jacob here. He wanted all of Jacob's proud, self-reliance, his scheming, his arrogance, and to take it from him, if forced by necessary. I can only imagine like what this scene looked like. I mean, it says that they wrestled until dawn began to break. I don't know if it was like barroom fighting, they're just like slugging each other in the face over and over, or if it was like MMA, like down on the ground doing that leg thing, or, WWE, like off the olive tree, down on top of them. I don't know. But it must have been intense. And I imagine they must have talked at some point during that, Like when I watch those MMA guys, I'm like, they're like cuddling. That's weird. Can only imagine what the scene looked like. Verse goes on, it says, when the man saw that he would not win the match, he touched Jacob's hip and wrenched it out of socket. Because you've seen that happen before, right? Where someone just like, you're like, leg comes out. No, like that doesn't just happen. In here we see that Jacob, he might have felt like he was pretty evenly matched against this man, right? He probably thought he was, as this progressed, he's like, man, I'm getting the upper hand here. But that was only an appearance. This guy could have easily won at any time. And this is kind of what I want to bring us to this morning, that sometimes, often, we believe that we can contend with God. My will, right? My way, my happiness, my kingdom. Someone in rebellion against God might even look like they're doing great for a time, but it's only appearance. That God can turn the tide at any moment, even let the match go on for longer than it needs to for his own purposes. It's not hard to imagine Jacob working so hard. Feel like he's getting the best of his opponent until finally, in that moment, the struggle changed. Then the man said, let me go. The dawn is breaking. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Of course, right? He needs more blessings. The man was letting Jacob know here that this struggle would not go on any longer. Jacob, you have been beaten. Jacob, though, clung desperately to this man. But Jacob had lost. A greater, better man had defeated Jacob. And this is an invaluable place for all of us to come to, where God conquers us. Acknowledging God's greatness after we have been defeated ourselves. We have to know that we serve a God who is greater than us. And we can't conquer much until he conquers us. Here's the thing, guys. We do not believe, if you haven't listened to anything else, I want you to get this one bit here, that we do not believe that God's grace is sufficient until we believe that we are insufficient. For many of us, especially American culture, this is a huge obstacle. We're the self-made man, right? I got this. But we can't receive God's strength until we know our own weaknesses. We cannot receive the sufficiency of God's grace until we know our own insufficiency. We cannot receive the sufficiency of God's grace until we know our own insufficiency. For some of us, this comes easier than others. One of the characters we're talking about later, they have self-doubt. That's like the opposite of what Jacob has here. I will not let you go unless you bless me. Jacob wasn't like negotiating terms here with God. Actually, we can see from the book of Hosea, there was a little bit more to Jacob, to this fight, than what we read there in Genesis. Even in the womb, Jacob struggled with his brother. And when he became a man, he even fought with God. Yes, he wrestled with the angel and won. He wept and pleaded for a blessing from him. There at Bethel, he met God face to face, and God spoke to him. This wasn't a, you need to bless me or else. This was a, God, I am broken. I am defeated. I need you. According to his past, Jacob was always clever and sneaky, feeling like he never needed to trust God alone. But now he could only rely on the blessing of God. Because here's the thing. I don't know if you guys have been here, but I have been there. He was reduced to that place where all he could do was to hold on to God. That was it. He couldn't fight. He couldn't struggle. He says, I'm just going to hold on. And that's not a bad place to be. Because here, God answered Jacob's prayer. Before Jacob could be delivered from the hand of his brother, he had to be delivered from his own self-will and self-reliance. And this hits me, even like in my approach to my family, to my life, even my ministry. How many of us take this on, that we are going to do this, that we got this. This is my kingdom. This is my thing I'm going to do. But Jacob thought the real enemy was outside of him, Esau. But really the true enemy was his own carnal, self-reliant, I got this nature, which had not been conquered by God. So this next part I love. What is your name? The man asked. He replied, Jacob. Jacob knew, admitting his name, what that meant and everything that came with that name. His past, his deceit, his lies, his tricks, he knew exactly what he was admitting to here. Your name will no longer be Jacob, the man told him. From now on, you will be called Israel, because you have fought with God and men and have won. You have fought with God and men and have won. Has Jacob prevailed here in the sense that he endured to the struggle until God has thoroughly conquered him? And sometimes it doesn't make sense to us why God puts us through what we're going through, whatever struggle we're in. We know that his ways are not our ways. But Jacob, this became a turning point in his life. For years, he had been struggling with people. But Jacob had also all along been struggling in his relationship with God. Jacob began a long period of genuine belief in God's promises, but he failed to live in the confidence of what God would truly do for him. He had this restless drive to gain benefits, and it reveals how his fears made him resistant to God's transforming grace. And I know that. I don't know if you guys have ever been there when you know you need to go to God with something. You can't go to him in prayer. For some reason, it just seems impossible. When we come to God, when we believe in his promises, when we drop this, I got this approach, we're going to become less inclined towards manipulating the circumstances around us to benefit ourselves. Yes, it's going to be hard. Yes, you will be hurt. You might even have a scar. Jacob walked away from this with a limp the rest of his life on his leg, right? And the end of the story goes, well, there he is with this, all of his family ahead of him, all of his wealth and possessions, and he's limping along towards 400-man army that's coming towards him with his brother who swore to kill him. His brother Esau welcomes him with open arms and loves him and forgives him. And Esau, or Jacob says that seeing your face is like seeing the face of God. We look at Jacob's life, there's really no compelling bravery in his life, right? There's no great wisdom in Jacob to speak of. And even so, we may be tempted to just think he was like a passive instrument. But here we are thousands of years later talking about Jacob, and through Jacob, his children would go on to be the 12 tribes of Israel. And through one of those tribes of Israel, a much, much better man was born. A man who struggled and fought the fight what we could never fought. The man who fought with sin and death and conquered it in a way we could never conquer it. I didn't mention this at the beginning of this sermon. We do a live Q&A. I think Adam said it at the very beginning here. So we'll take a couple of those questions now if we got any of those in. How do you recognize arrogance in yourself? How can you change it? Oh, really? You don't know? You don't see it in yourself? Okay. You got it. I think every one of us has that in some way, shape, or form. I think really it's that acknowledgement of who we are. I read this quote once, that this is a temple whose foundation is dust. My temple whose foundation is dust, but this dust is very important to my Heavenly Father. How do I change it? I think it's like, again, what Jacob went through is a real, having a true fear of God, not this like, oh, I think he's going to crush me, but it's acknowledging who God is, really seeing it for who he is and how he placed you here and what he can do with you. Because, yes, it kind of gets mixed up with this. We were talking about this the other day. Like, is it wrong to be proud of my kid when he hits a home run? No, absolutely not. But there's something different when we realize that we're taking pride in our accomplishments, our achievements, everything we've done to get us here. I should preface this to you. I'm going to probably say, like, I don't know, because I do not have all the answers. I'm not one of those kind of guys, but I'll do my best. So there we go. If a 21st century Christian were to live a life like Jacob, wouldn't he be counseled that God's judgment may be on him due to his arrogant lifestyle? Let me think about this again. Okay, if a 21st century Christian were to live a life like Jacob, wouldn't he be counseled that God's judgment may be on him due to his arrogant lifestyle? Not sure exactly, but I think I'm asking here if, like, you brought this on yourself kind of thing, if that's kind of what we're being asked here. I guess it depends on your counselor, but we definitely know that there are consequences to our actions, right? We know that if there's cause and effect. I'm struggling through this one here. Come talk to me afterwards. We'll talk about that one a little bit more because I'm not sure exactly what you're asking in that. How do I switch from being arrogant to a life that is God-centered? It is a process, and pretty much it's going to end after you die, I think, and then you're resurrected to a new body, and maybe then, but no. I think for me, I remember having a moment once, like, as a teenager, thinking about, like, so what's it like once I, you know, like, I've kind of arrived as a Christian, okay? I play the tambourine in my worship band. I know all the books of the Bible in order by heart. I even know the song that goes with it. knowing that it is a process, and for me, we talk about this thing in student ministry we call embracing the squiggle, okay? Some people say, if you can imagine like a little chart, you know, that our progress and our faith towards God would be like, you know, up and to the right. Like, here we are going closer and closer to Christ every day. Some people say, well, no, it's more like peaks and valleys, right? I get close and I drop down a little bit, up a little bit. In student ministry, we say it's more like a squiggle. If you can imagine a line, it just goes, right? It might feel like you're going backwards. I feel like you're going backwards in time. I don't know how like the vertices of the graph work out there. But I think that it is a process. It's having people in your life, being part of a life group, having people around you that can speak into that when they see that in your life. I mean, keeping this stuff front and center. I know for me, like different periods of my life, there's different things that God has laid on me that I need to work on myself here. So just knowing that it's a process, respecting the process, and that the goal of this isn't to be perfect. The goal of this is to be more and more like Christ and let others see Christ in who you are, every action, word, thing you say. It appears that God is on the side of an evil man. This looks like evil selfishness triumphing because God blesses him regardless of his evil actions. Yes, because that's the thing. Did you guys know in the whole Bible, there's no good people? Even this room, none of you guys are good, really, not even me. We are forgiven people, but it's, even through Joseph's story, one of his sons, we see how God uses horrendous situations and somehow he can transform those situations. Can God work through evil? I don't know if God is on the side of an evil man, but I think that God knew the end of Jacob's life and he knew what would get Jacob there. If you knew me, you'd say I was an evil man. If you knew me, you wouldn't listen to a word I have to say. I think all of us are an evil man in some way, but I think that the difference in Jacob, that he got to the point where he did surrender, where he was broken. But we know that from our lives. We've seen people who never get to that point. You know, like I was watching this show the other day about some guy who was like a counterfeiter, and he made all these like fake $100 bills. I'm like, this guy would have been an amazing graphic artist, right? But like, he decided to go the counterfeiting route. I don't know if that's a great example there, but yeah. God is using the evil man, but you know what? God is on our side too. We would say that you know, we kind of really blew the kids' minds at chaos this year when we told them that good people don't go to heaven. Forgiven people go to heaven. So I don't know if that helps. But. Is it Jacob and Esau sitcom on Netflix? Prime, right now media, I'd like to binge watch. No, but I'm certain that we can get you hooked up with that in one shape or form, or maybe in the lobby, Hank, and then we'll do a live performance for you there. So I actually heard Hank's voice in here somewhere. He has a very distinct laugh, so. All right. Well, guys, this was a really challenging sermon for me. Like, it's covering all those years of Jacob's life. But anytime I spend time in this, guys, I don't know if you know what it's like as a pastor, how hard and how convicting it is when you spend time in these stories, in these messages. I know in my own life, like I said earlier, that I'm constantly forgetting, after all the miracles I've seen in my life, what God has done for me, what he has provided for me. And I think for me, it takes moments to take a step back, the way Jacob got alone with God and was broken and admitted it. So guys, I thank you so much today. If you guys have any other questions, stop over, I'll be on the other side afterwards, answer any questions you guys have. Would you guys please pray with me? Heavenly Father God, you are incredible, God. That you use us, that you love us, God, that you have used imperfect people like Jacob, like me, like every person in this room to build your kingdom, God. God, I pray for people in this room right now that are feeling conviction in their own life about their arrogance, maybe in your face or in the face of others, that you will just melt that away. Let them see the beauty in who you are, the freedom you offer, that your way is better. God, I thank you for this church. Thank you for this community. Thank you how you've placed all these people here for a reason, this point in time. And I pray, God, that we will let you work through us and use us to change this world, to make an impact on eternity. God, we love you. It's in your name we pray. Amen.